seated. Court is ready to hear argument from petitioners in Universal versus Renaissance.
May it please the court, Mr. Douglas Alexander will present argument for petitioners.
May it please the court. Contractual obligations come in one of only two flavors. They are either express or they are implied. In this case, the Court of Appeals agreed that there was no express obligation to keep the hospital open for the entire 15-year term of the lease.
Let me ask you this. What if the agreement was just breached? What if they said, if one promise was dependent on the other, we will move here, we will rent this office space as long as you've got a hospital there. What if the contract was just breached? They didn't keep the hospital. I mean, you keep wording in terms of force to keep the hospital open. But just in terms of the contract being breached, one of the promises they made in it, what's the difference in the situation we have here?
Well, perhaps what we need to do is to look at the nature of the obligation and I think the best thing to do, I've got a handout that I think will answer that.
Variation on that theme.
What's that?
You acknowledge that you had an obligation to make reasonable efforts to perform under this contract. Let's assume the jury finds that you did not make reasonable efforts to perform under the contract. Then wouldn't you only be arguing about the measure of damages?
Well, perhaps if we had... First off, and we need to talk about the nature of the... We need to talk about two things with the variations of the theme. One, are we talking about an absolute obligation or a conditional one? And two, of course, in this case, we did not have reasonable efforts. I think that maybe the best thing to do is to turn to the operative instrument to address the question that you have, Justice O'Neill, and that's under tab 2 of the handout I have.
Well, but about, just on the basic concept, if they were mutual obligations... You're not contesting the measure of damages. If this is just a simple breach of an agreement.
If there was an absolute obligation, and in other words, that let's assume that there was an absolute obligation to keep the hospital open for the entire 15-year term of the lease, and that obligation was breached, then yes, we're not arguing about damages.
Well, let's say that the lease agreement says we... agree to provide you electricity to your premises.
Right.
And we will make all reasonable efforts to provide you electricity. And in return, you agree to lease the premises. And electricity becomes very expensive, and the landlord says, you're not going to provide electricity anymore.
Well, I mean, I think that in that circumstances, that would be a condition allowing there to be a termination of the lease.
And why would this not be? Why is this not similar? Because they're making the same argument that, you know, critical, that the
right.
hospital was sort of the electricity here, and you cut that off, we can't operate anymore.
Right.
Why is that different?
Well, this is the reason it's different. If we look at tab 2 of my handout, this is the October 11, 1995 agreement. Well, first off, if we look at tab 1, I mean, let's just go ahead and get that out of the way. And I won't spend any time on that. I really want to spend a lot of time on tab 2. Tab 1, you know, everybody agrees that nowhere in these lease documents is there any express provision to keep the hospital open. Okay. So what they're trying to do is we go to tab 2, and we need to focus on the language
of
tab 2.
Let me ask you this. If they had never opened the hospital, would that have been failure of a condition precedent?
If they had never opened the hospital, and again, under tab 2, that tells us that, then they never would have had an obligation to pay rent. That was the mutual obligation. Our obligation, if you want to look at it that way in terms of mutuality, was we were to furnish a facility. And this is true in any landlord-tenant case. The landlord's obligation is to furnish the premises. The tenant's corresponding mutual obligation is to pay rent. In this case, we furnished a $17 million facility. They, in return, were required to pay rent until there was a failure of a condition, at which point the lease terminated. This is what tab 2 is all about. And I really want to spend some time on it. Tab 2 is the 1995 letter agreement that they really rely upon as the source of the implied obligation to keep the lease open. Now, the language that you need to focus on is in that first paragraph that I have there. The validity and binding effect of the lease are subject to the following terms and conditions. This answers your question. There's mandatory language that's used, but understand the context. This was written 2 years before the hospital was ever opened. This was written before a site was ever selected. The lease was attached to this document. This document is prepared on the doctor's letterhead. It is as protection for the doctors. And what it provides is this. Look at the first one. A site for the project must be selected. Well, if Universal never selects a site, their binding obligation to pay rent never arises. Number two, you must have designed and construct the project according to plans and specifications. If you never do that, the mutual obligation never arises. Number three, shall proceed with construction. If we never construct it, the binding obligation to pay rent never arises. Number four, and we're getting close to the one that they seize on, shall use diligent efforts to obtain all licenses. If we don't get licenses, what's the illegal effect? No binding obligation to pay rent. And finally, number five, which is their key provision, thou shalt provide managed care contracts which mirror those of the doctors. And what that means, just briefly, is if they have Acme HMO under their deal and they have a patient that goes to Acme HMO, they want to make sure that when that patient goes downstairs, there's matching managed care contracts. That's a continuing obligation throughout the lease. Their argument, and this is the crux of it, let me just spend some time on this. Their crux of it is, if the hospital closes, you cannot meet the requirements of number five. You cannot have managed care contracts throughout the term of the lease. That is true. But what is the legal effect? The legal effect is stated at the very beginning. The validity and the binding effect are subject to the following terms and conditions. That condition fails. They can declare the lease invalid, not binding, and they can walk.
As I understand it, you could have a very profitable hospital, but decide that maybe a hospital in San Marcos would be slightly more profitable, and you could walk away. And if they change their name and relocate it and have to go contract at a higher price for similar quarters elsewhere, they're just out of luck. Is that right?
Well, I think we need to talk about theory and reality. Theoretically, yes.
Theoretically. That's how contract cases are.
Right, exactly. The reality is, of course, that what we are trying to do in this case is to get a return on a $12.9 million investment. Okay, in reality, what this hospital is trying to do is make a go of it. And to make a go of it, for 2+ years, they pumped $5.5 million into it down a hole. But the question becomes, once they've pumped it down the hole, do they have an obligation to keep pumping $2.5 million a year down the hole for 15 years? There's nothing here that says they do.
You say this is just a landlord-tenant. That's all this case is. It's just a landlord-tenant. And there's nothing in this landlord-tenant relationship that requires the landlord to keep the hospital operating for 15 years. So I'm a landlord, and it may not be reasonable, but I ultimately enter into a lease for 3 years with a tenant. And I say, tenant, this is your lease for 3 years, and it's in a shopping center. And the business is going fine, and the landlord decides, I can't make a profit from this center, so they shut down the center, turn off the electricity, and walk, and there's 2 years left on the lease. I understood your argument to be, well, see, that allows the tenant to walk. That's their recovery, that's their remedy. They can leave, and they have no further rent obligation. But don't they have some sort of damages against the landlord potentially? The landlord said that you've got this lease to use for 2 years. Your company is profitable, but now you're shut down. You have no electricity. You've got to now move your business. There is some liability for something other than you're now released from paying your rent. Doesn't the tenant have some claims against the landlord who does that?
No.
Okay.
Look at the Lilac Variety case. I think the Lilac Variety case is your hypothetical.
So the landlord has no obligation to honor the lease, subject to just simply losing the rent that they could have otherwise acquired.
Unless provision is made otherwise expressly in the lease. And once again, I would point you to the Lilac Variety case. Now, it may sound unwise, unjust, unfair. And that's where you're coming from. This doesn't seem fair. That ain't fair.
No. My hypothet was the landlord had given the tenant a 3-year lease.
That's right.
And there was 2 years left to go on the lease. This is a clear obligation for a term of years for the lease. You're, in that hypothet, you say the tenant's remedy is to be free from paying rent.
And unless the provision is made otherwise. And let me just give the facts of lilac variety, because, I mean, that's the case that we have in Texas jurisprudence on that. In that case, there was a tenant who says, look, I want these other anchor tenants to be here. And the landlord contracted, say, we will have these other anchor tenants here for you. One of the tenants left and was not replaced. What was the remedy? The remedy was that the tenant walked. Okay, now they'll say, well, that's because that was the provision that was made there for. Well, okay. But if anything, that demonstrates that that apparently, in that case, when the parties actually sat down and thought of it, they determined to be the appropriate remedy.
Well, now,
that is to say that they could walk.
The remedy for breach of contract is the benefit of your bargain, right? Why wouldn't that apply here? You're entitled to the benefit of your bargain. And the bargain here was this sort of, you operate the hospital, we'll lease the space. So it strikes me that, okay, they're entitled to what they could have made over the term of the lease, but then they'd have to mitigate. If the hospital's no longer there, they've got to find another place to go, and that would go to mitigating their damages. But I don't, this seems to me to just fit a typical breach of contract construct.
Well, and that's the problem. Here's the bargain. This is the bargain. I mean, the only document that they point to, if you read their respondent's brief on the merits, you know, we've talked about, there's three documents that submitted to the jury. The only document that they point to in their respondent's brief on the merits is the 1995 letter agreement. Okay, what is the bargain? This is the bargain. The validity and binding effect of the lease are subject to the following terms and conditions. Okay? That's their bargain. This was written by their attorney on their letterhead, and it's exactly the same type of bargain that was struck in Lilac Variety. You read the Lilac Variety case, nobody stands up and says, well, what about my moving costs? What about my lost profits? You know, if you maintain that tenant in there, I would have made more money. I get to recover that as well. Look at the Wild case, same thing. Refused case by this decision.
Well, but again,
no benefit of the bargain damages.
I need to understand, if you're looking at the language of the 95 letter agreement, I want to follow up on Judge Enoch's question, what if a jury were to find that Renaissance did not use reasonable efforts to obtain? Then...
Well, this is interesting. We're kind of a couple steps away from the type of benefit of the bargain that you're after, and let me address that.
Well, I mean, I guess the problem we're struggling with is the measure of damages appears to be the problem here, because the amount that was awarded presumed that the hospital had to stay open, but the measure of damages has never been contested, and I think that's the difficulty we're struggling with.
Well, I think, and rightly so, the question is whether any entitlement to a recovery of damages at all ever arose, or based upon what the parties contracted for, was the only right to walk the lease.
So you're saying this language restricted the measure of damages to...
It restricted, well, in effect, it restricted, if you want to look at it this way, the remedy. It restricted what the legal obligations of the parties was. That's correct. Absolutely. Look at the language. The validity and binding effect of the lease are subject to the following terms and conditions. In other words, what happens is, if the site is not selected, we don't get the mutual obligation of getting rent. If you don't design and construct it, we don't get the mutual obligation of paying rent. If we don't do all of these things, we don't get the rent.
Mr. Alexander, after 2 years of negotiating between the parties here, building the building, and the doctors relocating their practice, their patients, was there any implied term for the hospital to remain open? Could it have shut down after a week?
Well, once again, and I need to answer that in terms of technical reality. Yes.
Well, I'm interested in the law.
The law is
how this case should come out.
Okay. The law is they could have shut.
Did you say technical reality?
No. I said there's technical and then there's reality. I did not say technical reality. Or if I did, I misspoke. So I was talking about technicalities and realities. So technicality, and back to your legal question, yes, legally, they could have walked after 1 week. Now, let's talk about the real world. This is where I want to talk
when
about the real world.
When you say they, you mean your client could have shut it down after a week.
Correct. But let's think about how much sense would that make? You have now sunk $17 million into a facility. You are trying to get a return on your investment. What could be more? I mean, let's use another analogy. You know, I build a donut factory because I can relate to donuts more easily than hospitals. Donut factory, completely equip it, completely staff it, and then kind of go, you know, after 1 week, boo-boo, I'm going to shut it down. What sense would that make to do it? How do you get, where's the money coming from? It's not coming from the rent. These doctors are paying $450,000 a year, which is nothing compared to the return on investment. It would make no business sense to shut down a hospital after a week. That's why everybody expected it.
I thought the lease had an initial 5 year term.
Well, it has a term. He's talking about the situation where, you know, if you shut it down, what would happen? Okay, in other words, I mean,
what's the term of this lease?
Term of the lease is 10 years. It's an initial 10-year lease and then a optional 5-year term. And in terms of the mutual obligations, if we shut it down after a week, we don't get the mutual response of the rent.
But we don't
get all this other stuff.
But they went and paid higher rent somewhere else, you'd be liable for that under just typical landlord-tenant law.
Only if you were dealing truly with a... No, you wouldn't.
No, wait a minute. Somebody else came along and said, we'll pay you $500,000 a year for that space, and so you just kick Renaissance women out. You would breach this lease.
I think now we're going into...
I want theory. Theoretically, you could, under your reading of the lease, you could kick them out if you could find a better deal.
I think under that one... No, and now I'm starting to hedge back to the reasonable efforts. I mean, I think that in that type of situation, we really are dealing with reasonable efforts at that point. I mean, to the extent that you can incorporate some obligation to this, you might have a reasonable efforts obligation. We would not be able to just kind of go, hey, we found somebody better so we can do it. That would be actionable as damages. That's different from we are trying our damnedest to keep this thing open. We're paying $5.5 million to do it, and we can't do it.
So if I read this lease long enough, I'll see that. You can shut the business down for any reason at all, unprofitable or profitable, but you can't kick them out because you can find a higher paying tenant. That's going to be somewhere in here. It's not going to be implied or any other.
Well, one place that you might look for that, I mean, and again, this is giving them some benefits here. Look at number 5.
Number 5, talking about reasonable efforts to obtain and maintain in full force throughout the term, seemed to me to obligate you to keep this hospital open if it was a profitable, beneficial thing.
But it's qualified by reasonable efforts.
Right.
Reasonable
which
efforts.
Is different than your earlier answers. That's why I'm trying to parse through.
Okay, I understand. But I mean, to the extent that there's an obligation here, it would be one of reasonable efforts. And this is the language that they're hinging on.
But the case wasn't tried this way. I mean, a jury was not asked to determine whether there were reasonable efforts, were they?
Precisely right. I mean, that's another problem that there is with this. What the jury was asked to do...
But was this argument raised at trial? I didn't see that this argument was raised at trial, that the dispute was over the wording of the ambiguity instruction.
Well, and if you look at number 4, I mean, this was the wording. If you look at, it's, you know, tab 4, here's the jury instruction. What the jury was effectively asked to do here, if you look at what the jury was asked to do, which is let's read 3 agreements here and determine whether this obligation exists, what the jury effectively did, and again, if you look at the Weil decision, which I think is key, the jury effectively made an implied covenant analysis. That's what happened here.
What was your objection to that jury issue?
The jury, that it should not have been issued. Submitted at all, because this is an implied covenant case. Implied covenants are decided by the court, not by the jury. This case should never have gone to the jury.
Don't we have a fairly respectable line of cases saying that implied covenants frequently will have underlying factual disputes that do have to go to the jury? Pauls and Garrett versus Gorbett Brothers Welding, I'm sure, comes to your mind, just like it does to me.
It just leaked.
And,
Well... That certainly was not what was submitted here. In other words, again, we did not, I mean, look at the Weil decision. I mean, in the Weil decision, that was an implied covenant case. The court correctly said, this is not an issue for the jury. That was a case that was tried to jury. And the court, in a writ refused decision, said, this should never have gone to the jury. This is an implied covenant case. You apply, in an implied covenant, these five standards. And under these standards, they could not recover damages. What happened here is that the jury was effectively given the job of the court. And there's just no way around that. I mean, if you look at PJC 101.8, that tells us how you submit a contractual ambiguity, which is that you submit specific language that is ambiguous. We don't have that here.
Do you agree?
We don't have a single provision that's ambiguous in this entire agreement.
Yeah. Farnsworth says that a contract can, that vagueness can at times equal ambiguity. Do you think that's right or that's wrong?
I think that vagueness, if you're talking about a particular express obligation, can. In other words, I mean, let's talk about the greenhouse in Pecan Street. That is the classic example of a contractual ambiguity. That is to say, thou shalt deliver the goods to the greenhouse in Pecan Street. There are two greenhouses on Pecan Street. In that situation, the obligation is expressly stated, but it's vague. It's vague. But that's what distinguishes the contractual ambiguity case from our case. If you look again at tab one, here the court said there was no express obligation, absolute binding obligation, to keep this hospital open for the entire 15-year term of the lease. And that's why the court had to basically look for an implied one.
But there was an express obligation to use reasonable efforts.
Well, and again, and this is where I started to hedge back on some of the questions when we were talking about technicalities and reality. I think that, I mean, some of the answer, and also this might depend on good faith and fair dealing. You know, the notion that, you know, the landlord could go, well, I found a better deal. That would be a different case. That would be a different case. It's different when you have opened, you have tried, you are doing everything you can to keep it open. You're just pouring money down a rat hole. You close it down, then what do? You look at the operative agreement as to what happens. That operative agreement here is the 1995 letter agreement. And it merely says, in that situation, the lease becomes invalid, which means that they can walk, which is exactly the same remedy as Lilac. They might have contracted for something else, but they didn't, and where they don't, they cannot be bound by it.
Mr. Alexander, that's the problem.
You
said previously in answer to my question that if Universal shut down the facility after a week, that would be fine. There's no obligation implied for the hospital to stay open any minimum period of time, and that the hospital or Universal would not have to answer in a damages action either. Is that correct?
Well, and I've revisited that when I focused again on the reasonable efforts language, which is where they're injured.
My next question is going to be, could the doctors have done likewise?
Effectively, yes. Okay. In other words, and this is the situation. They could have, had they walked, they would have had to pay their rent. But what if the hospital says, but, we were wildly profitable with you here, and therefore we want to get our profits that we would have obtained? The answer to that would be, no, you cannot. Under this lease agreement, you can get your guaranteed rent subject to the duty of mitigation under the Austin Hill versus Palisades Plaza situation, but you don't get your lost profits. In other words,
you'd be objecting to the damages question and not the duty question.
Not at all. That's not what we would be doing.
You can't claim those damages under this contractual.
No, we'd be making the same argument, and that is we would be saying that under the contract that exists, all that happens is that, you look at the language in the contract, and again, looking back our way, if the lease is invalid, what does that mean? They don't have an obligation to pay rent. That's it. It's not a matter of objecting to the damages question. It's a matter of what is the obligation here.
Would that be
it's a conditional one.
Incidental and consequential damages.
In that situation? No.
Not removing costs? Not downtime? Have to remove?
Look at Lilac Variety case. In other words, and let me be very careful about that. What's going through your mind is it seems that it would have been reasonable for the parties to contract for something like that, or that those were reasonable to be. Okay.
That's a simple breach of contract measure of damages.
Well, but once again, we're back to talking about when you look at the letter agreement, where we're talking about a conditional obligation, and they really don't want to focus on that language. They do not want to focus on the conditional language. When we're talking about a condition, what happens when the lease is no longer valid and binding? I mean, all that means is, I mean, we've sunk in $17 million. They paid whatever rent they can. We can no longer insist on rent. We can no longer insist upon their mutual obligation to pay rent. But that's it. That really is it. That is, the provision is made, and every implied covenant case that's been decided in this state and every other state has examined it that way. The parties could have expressed it.
I think we're, that's enough, unless there's another question. Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Barry McNeil will present an argument for the respondent.
I'm Barry McNeil. I'm here on behalf of the plaintiff respondents, the physician clinic. You know, this case is not about an implied covenant on an exclusive remedy issue, which is what defense counsel seems to suggest. This case is not about a return on an investment. It's not about damages. It's not about conditional obligations. It's about the clear meaning of the October 11 agreement. There was no doubt at the trial that the October 11 agreement was front and center. There was absolutely...
You say clear meaning, you mean as a matter of law?
I mean as a matter of law.
So the Court of Appeals got the right result, but for totally the wrong reasons.
Well, I think they had an alternative, and I think they chose one of two courses.
So you're going to give us the first course, just read the agreement and go home.
Correct. Right. Yes, and Justice Phillips said... At the trial court level, as you know, both parties took the position that as a matter of law, they went. Both parties took the position at the summary judgment proceeding that the letter agreement and related documents were clear as a matter of law. The court decided that there was ambiguity with respect to the term and submitted that to the jury. There's no question that the charge is not on appeal at this point in time. I was struck in reviewing the record by the misdirection, if you will, that respondent counsel was hoping to achieve. I would ask that you look to tab C of our handout. It is critical, it seems to me, to the defendant Universal's argument on the basic contract question that it is critical to their argument that the case law, in their view, does not allow a court to find as a matter of law a contract to be unambiguous if there is no express literal language. That is the first thing they said. Because there is no express literal language that says Universal has to stay here during the term of the contract, of the lease, and because, in their view, the jury was just given a whole mass of documents and said, glean an agreement from that, I was struck by two things. First is that that's not what happened at the trial court. At the trial court, in closing argument, defense counsel said, I'm going to tell you all that you can look at that lease all you want to, but the documents that you really need to be looking at, the documents you are really going to be interested in looking at and answering these questions is the October 11 letter and the January 31 letter. Now, the January 31 letter only substitutes Universal for the Schusters, so it doesn't really relate to the October 11. At trial, from voir dire to opening, through the testimony of the witnesses, through the closing argument, there was no doubt but that this jury was focused on the October 11 agreement. So to the extent that defense counsel would suggest to you that the jury was somehow confused, wrong. To the extent that the defense counsel would suggest to you that if there is no literal language in an agreement that says the following, there can be no finding as a matter of law that agreement is unambiguous. Wrong. Columbia Gas, 1995, this court's opinion. Columbia Gas, a buyer and seller of natural gas. I'm sure you remember the case. The buyer and seller enter into an agreement that has two different pricing provisions. 311 sets out pricing that will take effect perhaps forever, but certainly until 1984 when a lot of gas was going to be coming on market because of deregulation. A second provision, 313, where there was a right to renegotiate by both seller and buyer. And what happened there was that the buyer chose to renegotiate under the second provision. They operated under that for a period of time. The seller then says, I want to go back to the first provision. Buyer said, you can't do it. Seller says, I can do it because the contract doesn't expressly say I can't. This court, of course, looked at that and said that even though there is no expressed, and this is tab E, if you will, Your Honor, Columbia Gas, the failure to include more express language of the party's intent does not create an ambiguity when only one reasonable interpretation exists. You must examine all parts of the contract and the formula and the circumstances surrounding the formulation. And then importantly, they said, the only reasonable interpretation of the contract is that one provision trumps another.
So I'll be clear. You said the argument is that the jury was confused, but it doesn't matter to your argument whether the jury was confused or not.
Correct.
And then I guess the premise to the argument you just made is there is no express language in these agreements one way or the other.
I think that to address the last first, there is express language. And I would like to go through that.
That's what we need to see.
And Justice Heck, I did not mean to say that the jury was confused. What I meant to say was
No, you said they argued that the jury
correct.
Was confused.
Correct. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, let me ask you real quick. I want to hear the express language, but let me ask you this question. What if we disagree with you? We agree with you the contract's not ambiguous, but we conclude that it's a reasonable efforts obligation. Where does that lead this case?
Where that leads is the reasonable efforts clause in paragraph 4 and 5 made clear that the parties had to shall use reasonable efforts to complete HMO agreements and to get licenses. That's what's clear from the agreement. There is no one suggesting in this lawsuit that they were unable to do that. In fact, those agreements were in place. If there had been a failure to obtain HMO agreements and they therefore had walked the lease, that might have been a lawsuit, it might not have been a lawsuit. That's not this lawsuit. There is nothing in that agreement, in those agreements, that suggests that Universal may walk the lease at its own choosing. Nothing. The reasonable efforts goes to obtaining the contracts. Once those contracts with HMO and PPOs are arrived at and achieved, and they are, then that condition is satisfied. And if you look then at a second modification, within the record, but not one of the documents I gave you, it becomes clear that the physician clinic is bound to the terms of that lease once those obligations are satisfied. If we could go to tab D, because I want to return to this precise language of the agreement. Tab I, incidentally, is the entire agreement, and what I did with tab D is take the first sentence of each of those paragraphs. But I am happy to discuss any of them because this is certainly not a case where we're trying to hide behind any particular provision.
The problem with these provisions, which are in your brief, and we've looked at them, is that you might put these same provisions in an agreement that said no matter what, we're going to stay married 15 years. Or in an agreement that said after a certain period of time, we all reserve the right to reconsider. And it's hard to see how these provisions would be inconsistent with either other position.
Well, if I may, Your Honor, go to paragraph 5.
All right.
And I must note that in the materials provided you, the second provision of paragraph 5 was not provided. In other words, in the other handout, the second provision is not provided. And I would like to direct your attention to the full paragraph 5. The Universal shall use reasonable efforts to obtain HMO agreements that the physician clinic desires. The second provision, though, importantly, is in the event that Universal does not obtain those agreements that the physician group had designated, it will obtain and maintain written agreements with benefit providers satisfactory to the physician group. And it will do that throughout the term of the lease.
Well, it just doesn't say that. That's the last part it doesn't say. So what I'm wondering is, if you were concerned at the outset, either side, either the doctors or the hospital, that this might fail, and then what? How would you word this differently? You would only say, we'll obtain and maintain written agreements up through the subject of paragraph 12 that lets you out of the agreement? Or?
Well, I guess my concern with the question, Your Honor, and perhaps I don't understand it, is that the parties are not suggesting that this particular provision was one not fulfilled. And we are suggesting that this particular provision, read and consistent with October 11 letter, suggests at the very least that if there is an obligation to keep HMO agreements throughout the term of the lease, then there is necessarily an agreement to operate a hospital.
Is there anything about reasonable efforts that could go to the feasibility of keeping a hospital? Or is it just reasonable efforts mean you've got to keep writing and keep begging to get these permits? And once you get it, if there wasn't a single customer, I mean, is there any amount of money they could have lost that would have made a difference?
No.
If the whole company goes under you are an unsecured creditor in the Chapter 7 proceeding. For your moving expenses, loss of profits, etc.
My answer to that would be that there's certainly nothing within the agreement that allows them to close after one day or one week or one month.
Right.
Or 9.5 years.
Or 9.5 years. Now, should they have chosen to do that? Because sometimes parties do resort to an efficient breach. They certainly may. I mean, they could have closed. They did close after 1 year, 2 years, 2.5 years. And that is certainly, anyone, as we know from contracts, has the right to breach an agreement. But there is a remedy that's available to the other party.
Do you have any cases from anywhere in the nation where a tenant recovers because the landlord shuts down the underlying commercial premises?
Recovers their lost profits? Is that the question?
Yes, or their moving expenses or attorney's fees or any of the other damages.
Well, I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor, but I would suggest, but I just don't know on that.
I mean, but that's the answer, no. And I'm just shocked because there have been, like in Lubbock, all the skyscrapers looked like they were L's or something after the tornado went through there. Were there no lawsuits that came out of that?
But I would suggest to you there's a reason that the case law is silent on that. And that is that in most instances, when there are landlord-tenant disputes, and this is the Lila case, and that's the Weil case also, in most instances, when the law addresses landlord-tenant disputes, it addresses them in the following context. Either one, a key tenant. So someone moves in relying upon a key tenant. And in those cases and in those contracts, typically, almost invariably, there is a provision that allows another tenant, a non-key tenant, to exit.
Right.
And but
does he get his lost profits? That's the question.
Because of the contract, he does not. Because of the provisions within those particular leases. And I think, Justice Heck, that there is a long line of landlord-tenant cases that would suggest that typically deal with, number one, a key tenant issue, and number two, whether the contract allows them to do anything other than walk.
So if the contract were silent in a key tenant case, key tenant moved out, though, other tenants could get their lost profits.
Well, I think the answer to that is look at ordinary contract law. Look at ordinary contract law and define their rights at that point pursuant to an ordinary construction. What is the contract that they have?
The contract doesn't say, but clearly it does say we don't want this premises if the key tenant goes away. That's the whole point of being here. And so the key tenant goes away, they leave, and so they say, well, then we want out of the lease. Clearly they can, because the lease says they can. And maybe if there's fault on the landlord's part, they could get moving expenses or lost value of the lease or something. But could you get the lost profits that you were going to make had the key tenant stayed in, the anchor tenant stayed in?
I guess my answer to that is the same as I just mentioned, and I think it just depends solely upon the contract.
Well, let me ask you a question.
I'm sorry. I think it depends upon how the court or the jury at that point would look at that arrangement. I mean, ordinary contract law would suggest that you look to the circumstances surrounding the entry of that contract. It would the conduct of the parties, and my suggestion to you, Justice Hack, would be that in this particular instance, it would be off the mark indeed if we and you were to look at this as an ordinary landlord-tenant case.
No, I think you're right about that. But it seems to me if you had asked either side of this agreement or either side of most agreements, do you mean to stay put till you go to the bottom, they're going to say, well, no, I don't mean that. Neither the doc. If you said to the doctors, are you guys really going to stay in this lease, even if you start losing a huge amount of money a year, they're going to say, no, we don't mean that, but we just don't think that's going to happen.
Let me ask.
But does that suggest that, therefore, if the doctors were to pull out, the Universal would have no remedy with respect to the law?
No, it suggests to me you have a remedy, but would you get lost profits? That's the question.
And I'm suggesting to you that I'm suggesting two things on that. One is that is a remedy issue.
Right.
That is a remedy issue, and that issue is not before this court. For whatever reasons.
It depends on what you can get for this contract. Because you could clearly put in the contract, if anybody leaves before the end of 15 years, you get not only moving expenses and the lost value of the lease or the lost value of the tenant, and maybe you mitigate or you don't have to, and lost profit. I mean, you can put in there whatever the parties would agree to.
And I would just suggest, with all respect, Your Honor, that could be put into any contract, anywhere, anytime. Right. And ordinarily, we don't see remedies put. We don't see the various lost profit remedy formulations put into contracts.
I'm going to change the analogy a little bit and have it a little bit closer to this case. This is not a key tenant issue. Is there any case out there where the landlord, the shopping center itself, because it loses a key tenant, shuts down the shopping center and therefore cuts every other tenant free? Is there any case there where there's a lost profit complaint that could be made? And you understand that the distinction is, I'm not the tenant who argues lease is breached because you lost some other tenant. I'm arguing I'm leasing this space in this shopping center from you. I have a profitable enterprise. I've been operating for 3 years. I have a 5-year lease. But because you, for economic reasons, decided you were going to shut down the shopping center, I now am cut free with 2 years left on my lease. There's no case out there that talks about whether or not the tenant can get lost profits for the 2 years on that remaining period of that
tenant. I don't know, but I would suggest to you that's in the instance of a landlord just closing down the whole shopping center, going away, and tenants being dispossessed. I would suggest to you that they may or may not have a lost profits formulation. It depends upon the contract that they have and the deal that they entered into.
But isn't that what happened here? Wasn't this hospital shut down? And the argument is there was an agreement that you would be operating this hospital for a period of years?
Well, what?
Isn't that the argument here?
Well, the argument here is that is
they had an obligation. I was leasing from them a hospital that I understood was going to be a 15-year period, and we're arguing about what the length of that time was supposed to be, and they shut it down. Isn't that what the argument is? Or maybe a...
No, I think that is. I mean, the argument here, the lawsuit, is based on the fact that they had an obligation, in our view, for the term of the lease. And that obligation was not fulfilled. And that obligation was not fulfilled because of certain deficiencies that were more or less anticipated, if you will. It was not fulfilled because they simply chose to shut it down after 2.5 years at considerable cost to the physician group. The issue then...
You're arguing about how long a term it was at this enterprise you were supposed to be leasing this facility.
And I'm suggesting to Your Honor that the only issue before this court, in my view, is whether... It's not that issue, because that's a remedy issue, and that's a damage issue. The only issue before this court is whether there can be any reasonable reading of this contract that would permit a judge or a jury, and a jury in this instance, to find that the term of this contract was 10 years. That is the only issue before this court.
Well, let me ask you, it strikes me that this case has changed in theory from the trial court to here. Would that be accurate?
It has not on our side. I can't speak for the other.
Well, because we're talking about lost profits and what kind of damages, and that issue is not really before
Correct.
Us.
That is true.
So if we were to determine, just trying to figure out where we go with our analysis, we either say it's unambiguous in your favor or it's unambiguous in their favor. But if we say we can't tell it is ambiguous, then
they
the trial court properly submitted it.
Correct.
So it's all for you or all for them, or the trial court acted correctly.
Well, I would state it, that is correct. The way I would state it is that the only way in which the petitioners can prevail in this court is if you find that there is no reasonable reading of that contract that would permit a 10-year term, if you will. If you find that either one, as a matter of law, there was a 10-year term, because look at the various paragraphs, and look at the must and the shall, or if you find alternatively, heck, I don't know what it is. I don't know whether it's a 10-year term or not. Then we, of course, prevail, because the jury was giving an ambiguity instruction, and they answered it in our favor, and they did not appeal that.
All right, but where does the implied covenant analysis come in?
Out of them.
Well, I mean, was that ever raised in the trial?
Clear blue sky, in my view.
Was that
It
raised?
Was, in fairness, they touched on it. That was really focused when it came to this court.
But you have an alternative argument that there was an implied agreement. If we don't buy your express agreement.
Three legs.
But that was that leg preserved anywhere before we got here? There's an implied agreement based on all these terms to stay open.
I think that issue is before this court, yes. I think our position in candor, Your Honor, has been initially at the trial court, unambiguous. Secondarily, though, when the court said before the trial began, it's ambiguous, I'm going to submit it to the jury, the trial proceeded on that basis. And then thirdly, if this court should ride, and if I just might button it down by, if this court chooses to ride on implied covenants, which I think is a big, big mistake, because I think you're going to have to deal with Columbia Gas, and I think you're going to have to deal with Coker, if this goes off on an implied covenant basis, and I don't know how you're going to do that, but in any event, if this court chooses to imply a covenant here, it can only be implied in our favor, in my humble opinion, because implied covenants arise when you're looking at language and it is clear that the parties intended that particular result. And that gets us back to the matter of law on the lack of ambiguity. But there would be the three legs. One, it's unambiguous. Two, it is ambiguous. It was given to the jury. That issue is not before the court. And then three, if you need to imply a covenant, and again, I suggest that'd be a miracle opinion, that it could only be applied.
Mr. McNeil, that this case was submitted to the jury, it looks like, on the assumption solely that the hospital had an obligation to maintain operations for the entire term of the lease. I don't know if that means 10 years or 15 years. The question number one to the jury just says the entire term of the lease. The damages question is predicated on that, whether it's for attorney's fees, lost profits, or the other items of damages. So that as submitted to the jury, we have to find that either it's ambiguous and there's some evidence to support what the jury says, or that as a matter of law, your reading is correct. And I think you pointed that out. If, God forbid, from your standpoint, we find that the law is not ambiguous but disfavors you, what's the remedy then?
Well, if you find that this contract is unambiguous as a matter of law and in favor of the respondent, of course, this matter's over.
No remand, render.
Well, I mean, if you find, as a matter of law, then there is no recourse, of course.
Were there?
But could I, if I could, Justice Wainwright, go back to one moment. one thing just for a moment. The sufficiency of the evidence, which you alluded to a moment ago, is really not before this court either. You had mentioned that evidence sufficiency was an issue. That was an issue at the Court of Appeals. That's not an issue today. There's no question about that.
No, we reviewed legal sufficiency, not the other purpose. Are there any other damages that the doctors could have sought at the trial court besides lost profits and moving expenses and attorney's fees and the cost of setting up the new practice?
Are there any other damages? Well, they had a $5 million guarantee, unconditionally, personal guarantee, two of the physicians, for the term of the lease. So they unconditionally guaranteed the lease for $5 billion for 10 years. That certainly would be a measure of damage. They had, they guaranteed a $1 million debt for relocation, and there were other costs associated with both relocating their practice there in the first place and then relocating it afterwards. So there could have been an alternate submission that would have roughly achieved the same amount of money.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Let me start my rebuttal.
If the court finds that the plaintiffs were entitled to a dollar, then they get the whole verdict because you're not challenging any damages.
It's not. We're not challenging the measure of damages.
It's all or nothing. If they're entitled to anything at all, then we affirm.
It's all or nothing. Okay. This is not a. This is and yes.
And if we find ambiguity, you lose.
Correct. Now let me go back to your initial question, which I answered poorly. And that was talking about breach of contract. I want to make two things clear. This is the way the premises worked. Second floor is the doctor's space. First floor is the hospital. This was the only space that was rented. If you turn to page 17, if you look at page 17 of the lease, paragraph 6, that is services to be provided by the landlord, which includes air conditioning, janitorial service, electric service. If we were to shut off the lights in the lease space, that is breach the lease, they get consequential damages. If we were to turn off the air conditioning, if we were to do anything to try to kick them out, any of the things, fail to provide water, fail to do the passenger elevators, any of the things that are required under the lease, they get consequential damages. The issue here is not, none of those things were done. The issue here is what, and they did not lease the hospital. Let that be very, very clear.
Well, are you willing for them to stay on the second floor for
yes.
13 more years?
Correct. And we'll keep the lights on. We'll provide the air conditioning. Absolutely. Correct.
So the
this is not a lease of
much, the hospital is truly much like a key tenant.
The hospital is like a key tenant, and every single case in this country that has ever faced this type of situation has analyzed it as an implied covenant case.
What
that is why it is
this building after everybody left.
What's that?
What's happened to this building?
I believe it's just sitting idle still.
And still owned by Idly
owned. No, it's been sold. It's been sold. But, yeah. But this is what you need to make clear is that this is the lease space. This is the key tenant space. Every case in the country is analyzed as an implied covenant situation, which is why I answered your question, Justice Phillips. They can't point you to a single case in lost profits.
Doesn't that beg the question? I mean, if we were just looking at a lease, you'd say, well, if you're going to give us electricity, we're going to rent the space. But in this situation, they came to that space because of hospital being here.
No question. And there was an expectation that it would do well. Let me take, you know, Justice Enoch's question, follow up. Justice Enoch, when they talked about shutting down the shopping center, let's make sure we have it clear. Are we shutting down their space as well? Are we turning out their lights? If so, if the answer is yes, we're turning out their lights, they get consequential damages. If we've done anything to breach the lease of the tenant in the shopping center, then you're liable for consequential damages. But the question here becomes, what do you do in the situation where the question is, what control do we have over our space? What can we do? What economic decisions can we make? And the answer is, there is nothing in the lease, if you look at the services to be provided by landlord, there's nothing that says, and you shall provide a fully functioning hospital continuously for the term of this lease. There isn't, it's not there.
It's not in the lease, but it's in the October 11th agreement.
It is not in the October 11th agreement.
Well,
there is a condition,
that's what
that's what they're arguing. That's what we're arguing about. And the analysis is strictly implied covenant because, as the Court of Appeals concluded, there is no express obligation to keep a hospital open anywhere. It isn't there. That's why we're not in ambiguity territory. In every ambiguity case that you will find in this state or in this country, the obligation is expressly stated. Thou shalt deliver the widgets to the greenhouse on Pecan Street. It's express. It's vague. It's ambiguous, but it's express. You will not find a single contractual ambiguity case where the obligation is just wholly missing, as it is here. They are trying to extract it out of a conditional obligation situation.
What about the language they point to? Universal shall use reasonable efforts and will obtain and maintain written agreements.
Let's take a look at that language. Or what? Go back to the very beginning, the language that they don't want to talk about. I don't even think it appears there, which is this. The validity and binding effect of the lease are subject to the following terms and conditions. If we don't build the thing, if we don't maintain these things, then they can walk, and that is the only thing that is provided for. It's exactly the same as in Lilac Variety. What they're saying is we should be able to get more, but there's nothing that gives it to them because there's no express obligation, an absolute obligation, unlike the obligation to provide air conditioning, lights, all of the things that you correctly point out would give rise to consequential damages. There's nothing in the 1985 agreement that gives them the right to say, geez, if we do well, we get guaranteed our profits for the entire term of the lease. It ain't there. And that's what they got.
Thank you. That concludes the argument.
All right.